You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 164 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Value of Thinking, 11 Lectures, translated by Christian von Arnim. This is Lecture 7, given in Dornach on the 2nd of October, 1915. So we continue today with our consideration of the pamphlet titled Science and Theosophy by F. von Rangel. Before doing so, I would like to briefly recapitulate some thoughts that could be related to the various chapters so far. First of all, I would like to mention why the points of view in this pamphlet can be of importance for our consideration. I have already said that in the present day we are living in circumstances which can put those who stand on the ground of spiritual science in the position of having to defend spiritual science against the various attacks to which it is exposed. Now, in our present time, a defense will be particularly necessary when the attacks come from science, for the reason that science, which has developed in a certain form for 3 to 4 centuries, can with a certain right claim to establish a world view, and actually does make this claim. So as a spiritual scientist, you can hear it said, well, if spiritual science has nothing to say about the objections of science, then it proves to be poorly founded, because anyone who wants to represent a world view today must be able to defend it against the objections of science. Therefore, it is particularly important to take note when a scientist appears and discusses what he has to say about the relationship between genuine scientific thought and theosophical teachings and spiritual teachings in general. The previous considerations have shown you that it can be particularly important if words are spoken in support of spiritual teachings precisely from the point of view that is determined by a consciousness that has engaged in astronomical and similar scientific research. I have pointed out how a representative of the modern worldview, Dubois Raymond, invokes the so-called Laplacian mind, the astronomical knowledge of the world. I have shown what the modern human being imagines by the Laplacian mind, by the astronomical understanding of the world. It is therefore necessary to show how far a comprehensive worldview can be built out of such astronomical conceptions. Then I said that it was important that this pamphlet pointed out that from theoretical materialism, from the theoretical materialistic mechanical conception of the world, practical materialism must of necessity gradually follow. I then showed how spiritual science must also adopt this standpoint, even though in our present day the objection is often raised that theoretical adherents of the materialistic mechanical view of the world do not deny the validity of ideal ethical motives, but on the contrary, profess them. We then saw in the pamphlet, in a beautiful way, what kind of world view results for those who want to place themselves exclusively on the standpoint of the mechanical materialistic world view. I sketched out this image of the world to a certain extent, and particularly emphasized, which is also emphasized in the pamphlet, that anyone who sees the mechanical materialistic image of the world as all-embracing cannot regard the inner experiences which take place in the consciousness of the human being as essentially different from other natural processes, that is, as anything other than byproducts of mechanical materialistic processes. And that if such a mechanical materialistic view of the world is established, there can logically no longer be any question of the survival of an inner core after death. The pamphlet then moves on to examine this basic assumption. In particular, it points out how freedom and morality relate to basic mechanical materialistic conceptions, how the concept of freedom and responsibility cannot possibly still be held if we completely subscribe to the materialistic, mechanical view of the world, and how the actual question or riddle of the universe arises from this, namely that it is necessary to obtain such a conception of the world within which the ideas of freedom and responsibility can have a place. Then it is pointed out how we have only gradually arrived at the idea of a general application of laws spread out, as it were, as a network over all phenomena, and also how it is impossible ever to disprove free will by experience, because, as we have seen, free will can never be thought to be so interwoven into this network of materialistic mechanical processes as it would have to be if one were to profess this very image of the world alone. Then, in an epistemological discussion, it is shown how the human being enters into a relationship with the outside world through their senses, how to conceive of the formation of concepts, of conceptions, the formation of the conceptions of space and time. It is pointed out how the principle of causality ought to be a general principle of the worldview, but how it has only gradually entered the worldview because it was originally assumed that similar real motives were present in things as they are present in human beings themselves. So that development would show that the human being did not originally proceed from a mechanical causality, but basically only worked their way toward the mechanical materialistic view from a different view about the connection between phenomena. Then it is pointed out how in more recent times scientific observation has attempted to achieve objectivity. Now the very particularly important principle of materialistic mechanical science, the principle of measurement, is explained, and we shall see in a moment how this principle of measurement has further consequences also for the more complicated parts of present-day science. Now, I would like to draw your very special attention to what is written in the pamphlet about measuring. Truly, I would like to ask you to use it as a starting point to obtain an understanding of the character of the modern scientific approach precisely through this discussion about measurement. We have seen how the principle of measurement is then applied to the principle underlying clocks. I would now like to make a few remarks, particularly about the principle of measurement, in order to show you how you could use this chapter of Rangel's pamphlet, Science and Theosophy, as a kind of leitmotif to tie in with what you can find in the various arguments about the modern scientific approach, precisely with reference to the character that is required of a real scientific approach in the present day. We've seen what the nature of measuring is, and we have also found an indication of how measuring, in a certain respect, introduces a kind of uncertainty, in spite of all the objectivity in the observation over which it extends. We can point out this uncertainty very simply by saying the following. When we have simple measuring lengths or spaces, we base it on a base unit, a measuring stick. If we have to measure a length, we have to do it in such a way that we determine the relationship of the length to a measuring stick. The length must be given in the sensory world, and our measuring stick must also be realized in the sensory world. Now, you find a remark in the pamphlet that points out that something is introduced that makes measuring uncertain. Measurement is based on comparing something with the measuring stick. We compare how often the measuring stick is contained in what is to be measured. Now, however, a slight warming, for example, results in heat expanding the measuring stick. So let's assume that the measuring stick has been heated and has thus become a little longer. Of course, since we are measuring in a space that shows approximately uniform heat, otherwise we would have to envisage further complications, the thing to be measured would be extended in the same proportion as the measuring stick. But if the measuring stick and the thing to be measured are made of materials that do not expand to the same extent, so that the measuring stick expands less or more than the thing to be measured, then we are already dealing with inaccuracies in measurement. So we can highlight two things. One is, the observation becomes independent of our subjectivity, of the observer. We compare what is to be measured with the measuring stick, That is, we compare something objective with something objective. This is the basis of a good part of modern science, and basically it also constitutes an ideal of modern science. The other is if we simply looked at things around us according to our subjectivity. For example, you only need to imagine the following. Imagine you have a vessel with water in front of you. Now move your one hand close to the stove and hold the other hand into a pool of ice. Then put both hands into the water. You will have a very different feeling in each hand, even though the water is the same temperature. To the warmed hand, the water will appear cold. To the cold hand, it will not appear cold at all. In this way, the subjective extends over everything objective. This is only a crude example, but you can see from it how the subjective always underlies all observation. Measuring detaches the content from the subject, from the observer. Therefore, there is an objective truth, a cognition, detached from the subjective. That is important. And because in more modern times greater and greater efforts have been made to become independent of the subjective with regard to our view of the world, measurement has become a kind of ideal. You see, measuring becomes so objective because the measuring stick is independent of us, because we eliminate ourselves and insert the measuring stick in our place. Those who remember the lectures I gave in Berlin on the different standpoints we can adopt toward the world will see that something similar also underlies spiritual science itself. I said there, as long as we stand on the ground of external reality, we confront the world and create an image of the world for ourselves. But as soon as you enter the spiritual world, you basically have to look at what you are observing from different viewpoints. But now the viewpoint is meant spiritually. I mentioned 12 standpoints, and it is only when you take these 12 standpoints that one standpoint always corrects the other. This also makes us independent of subjectivity in a certain way. You see from this how science and spiritual science move in tandem, how that which lies as a necessary developmental motive in science, objectivity, must also be striven for by the spiritual scientist, though not by asserting all 12 standpoints. The 12 different standpoints correct each other. Thus, measurement is the detachment from subjectivity. But on the other hand, the point is made how even in measuring, accuracy can only be achieved within certain limits. And it is pointed out by Rangel in the next chapter, quote, limit of error during measurement. It is also possible to specify the limit of accuracy, or more correctly, the limit of error in time measurement, as in length measurement. Within these limits, the fact obtained is objectively correct, but it never achieves error-free correctness. In this, all facts taken from sensory perceptions differ from intuitive truths of the thinking, such as the formal laws of logic and all truths of mathematics. Close quote. Thus, while measurement is rightly put forward as the tool which, when the limit of error is taken into account, gives a certain accuracy in relation to an image of the world, it is at the same time pointed out how this accuracy, which can be achieved in relation to the external sensory world, can never be error-free accuracy. It can never provide the same kind of truth that we have in the so-called intuitive truths of thinking, in the formal laws of logic, and in the truths of mathematics. The next chapter is a further elaboration of what I have already said. Quote, absolute validity of logical and mathematical truths. The logical truth, for example, a part is smaller than the whole. Close quote. Steiner again. That is a mathematical truth. It cannot be said with absolutely equal certainty how many times a part is contained in this line. Presumably a line on the blackboard was pointed to. Quote, or if two things are equal to a third, they are also equal to each other, is not subject to any restriction. Close quote, Steiner again. These are absolute truths. But they are also not gained through external perception, but through thinking. Quote, every person of sound mind acknowledges its compelling necessity. This is also the case in mathematics. If certain basic assumptions have been agreed upon, all of the theorems of mathematics follow with compelling necessity without any restriction. If, for example, we agree on what is called a straight line, what is a right angle, what we call parallelism, the propositions of geometry follow from this with absolute certainty. Close quote, Steiner again. It is necessary to come to an understanding on these matters. It is necessary to agree on what a right angle is, what a straight line is, what parallelism means. Once it has been agreed that parallel lines are those that are equidistant from each other at all points that lie vertically above each other, or once it has been agreed that parallel straight lines are those that, no matter how far they are extended, never intersect, then parallel lines can be used to gain insight into further theorems of mathematics. I now want to tie in something seemingly quite remote. Let's say we have a triangle here. We have discussed many times that the three angles of a triangle together are 180 degrees. Well, what are 180 degrees? 180 degrees is if you think of a point here and a straight line drawn through that point. A 180 degrees is contained in the arc around this point, which is a semicircle. So it should be possible to arrange these three angles, A, B, C, in such a way that if you put them together in a fan shape, they form a straight line. This can be illustrated very easily by drawing the parallel to the straight line A, B through the point C here. And there is a diagram. Then it follows, once we have agreed on the parallel, that the angle A must be equal to this angle A, and the angle B must be equal to B. Now the three angles lie next to each other in a fan shape and form 180 degrees. I should still introduce intermediate links, but you will see that the truth that the three angles of a triangle together are 180 degrees is built on this. That is to say, there are certain basic truths of mathematics that result from thinking activity itself, about which we have to come to an understanding, and from which the whole of mathematics then follows. Quote, a person who has the ability to follow the line of reasoning is as convinced of the eternal validity of the final proposition as he is of his own existence. Close quote. There can never be any doubt that the angles of a triangle together are 180 degrees. For those of our distinguished friends who know something about it, I emphasize that we disregard spatial geometry, which would take us too far today. Quote, spatial science, geometry, establishes certain relationships between area content and its linear size, as well as between parts of space and the corresponding linear size. Close quote. This is the simplest idea, because if you draw a rectangle for yourself, the area of this rectangle is the area that I am shading. State the length of the baseline A, that of this line B. This is how you get the area when you multiply A by B, that is, you compose the area from linear size and linear size. Quote, these relationships were discovered by thinkers through intuition and logically linked with already known truths, that is, the mathematical proof. The correctness of the proof is not tested by experience, but is directly recognized by intuition. Close quote. It is very important that you should engage with this matter. How, in this respect, mathematical reasoning and mathematical cognition in general differ from all cognition that relates to external sensory objects. We can never have the latter without approaching the external sensory object. So, you have to take into account all the inaccuracy that comes into play. However, you do not need to draw mathematical constructs at all if you want to carry out a proof, but they are a consequence of autonomous thinking. Drawing is only an illustration for sluggish thinking that does not want to work within itself. But in and of itself, you could think of doing mathematics without any visualization in the inner imagination. Quote, we must never overlook this deep fundamental difference between facts taken from experience, which always have sources of error due to the limitations of our senses, and logical or mathematical truths which have absolute validity for us humans, as soon as we have recognized the basic assumptions as correct. If a conclusion is drawn from any empirical fact by a chain of mathematical or logical propositions, The former is only correct within the limitations under which that empirical fact was observed. Only with this limitation can the final result obtained be accepted as a scientifically proven fact of experience. This is often overlooked. Such empirical facts, when applied to phenomena of the sensory world, can lead to correct practical and also theoretical results, and often they reach such a high degree of probability that this probability seems to us equivalent to certainty, but epistemologically it is not. Close quote. Steiner again. The next chapter is called, quote, "All laws of nature are taken from experience and therefore have only conditional validity." When we speak of laws of nature according to which, when certain conditions exist, certain phenomena necessarily occur, or, in other words, certain causes necessarily have certain effects, these laws are taken from experience and can therefore only be proved to be correct within certain limits of accuracy. Let us illustrate this with a few examples. The astronomer says that the Earth rotates around its axis at a uniform speed. What does he mean by that? Close quote, Steiner again. So you can recognize certain mathematical truths inwardly, but you cannot recognize inwardly that the Earth rotates on its axis. So what does the astronomer mean by this? Quote, "First of all, this means we have substantial reasons to believe that the apparent daily rotation of the starry sky is an optical illusion and is caused by the rotation of the Earth's sphere around its axis. The duration of such a revolution is called a sidereal day. In order to measure the duration of a sidereal day, that is, one revolution of the Earth on its axis, we have to compare it with a duration of time that we regard as unchanging. As such a unit of time, we choose the period of oscillation of a pendulum of a certain length connected to a clock. Experience shows us that the better the conditions are fulfilled to ensure the regular running of a clock, and the more accurately we make the observations of the stars, by which the duration of one revolution of the Earth is determined, the more constant proves to be the relation between the number of oscillations of the pendulum and the number of revolutions of the Earth. With the current state of the art, the rotation of the Earth is proven to be uniform within the possible error limits, which can only reach a small fraction of a second. We cannot claim absolute uniformity. Indeed, we have reasons to doubt it." Close quote. Steiner again. We do not need to address the last sentence. It can be the subject of a later reflection. What is it now that is actually subject to external observation? Firstly, the phenomenon that we have as day and night on Earth, and secondly, the comparison with the oscillations of a pendulum clock. And since we find from other premises that the pendulum swings uniformly, and that we can compare the uniform swinging of the pendulum with what we perceive in relation to the Earth, we must conclude from this that the Earth also turns uniformly about its axis. Another explanation is given in the next chapter in relation to chemistry. Quote, "Chemical laws. It is similar with chemistry. The whole edifice of this science rests on the proposition chemical compounds can only occur in very special quantities by weight of their indivisible constituents." Close quote. Steiner again. As an example of this, a footnote states, quote, "For example, one unit by volume, say 1 liter, of oxygen, combines only with 2 units by volume of hydrogen to form water." Close quote. So one atom of oxygen combines with 2 atoms of hydrogen to form a molecule of water. I have often spoken of this combination of oxygen with hydrogen to form water. Then the footnote goes on to say, quote, "Since an atom of oxygen is 16 times heavier than an atom of hydrogen, we can also say 1 unit by weight of hydrogen combines with 8 units by weight of oxygen to form 9 units by weight of water. If there is more oxygen in the mixture than 8 times the amount of hydrogen by weight, the excess remains as free, uncombined oxygen. If, on the other hand, there is less oxygen, the excess hydrogen remains uncombined." Close quote. So only in this very specific ratio does oxygen combine with hydrogen to form water. In the water, they are present in this ratio. There is no other way for them to combine. quote, or technically speaking, the elements only enter into chemical compounds in whole multiples of their atomic weights, close quote. Steiner again. This sentence now contains the whole hypothesis of the atom. What is stated here is correct for the whole of sensory perception, for the observation of quantities by weight and relationships by volume. But if we assume that the oxygen and the hydrogen consist of the smallest parts, no longer divisible atoms, then we must assume that the same specific relationship also occurs between the atoms. And since we can no longer divide the atoms, when oxygen combines with hydrogen, that is, when one smallest part of one combines with two smallest parts of the other, the same weight ratio must exist. If we take the atomic weight of oxygen and the atomic weight of hydrogen, we get a weight ratio. That is, one atom of oxygen combines with two atoms of hydrogen, with the oxygen atom being 8 times heavier. The whole multiple of the atomic weight goes into the compound. What do we have to do to discover something like that? You have to weigh something, which is also a measurement. So you take the sensory facts, and from the result of weighing, you get this law that the individual substances do not combine in an arbitrary way, but in a very specific ratio. Quote, however, the empirical facts from which this law is taken are never completely accurate, because all weighing and measuring is subject to errors of observation. If the law, nevertheless, expresses an absolute, this is intended to say the following. The more precisely the apparatus used for chemical analysis is constructed, the more careful the methods for breaking down aggregate compounds into indecomposable elements, the better the composition of the substance from elements can be represented by a combination of multiples of the corresponding atomic weights of these elements. Since the chemist is aware of the possible limits of error of their measuring operations, they know whether the final result of their analysis is in accordance with the above law, within these limits of error, or not. If they find a greater deviation, they are so convinced of the correctness of the law that they assume the presence of a still unknown element to explain the deviation they have found, or they look for an unnoticed source of error. Thus they consider the law to be absolutely correct in practice, although they are theoretically aware of the conditionality of this empirical law. Close quote, Steiner again. That is to say, if it were found from other empirical facts that two or three elements combine according to a certain ratio, and if another ratio were seen in the substances in which these are contained, then it would have to be assumed that there is something else in them. The next chapter is called, quote, Physical Laws. When physics states the law of conservation of energy, it means that if we convert a certain amount of kinetic energy into heat and compare the numbers expressing the amount of kinetic energy in its units and expressing the amount of heat generated in calories, units of heat, we get a ratio called the mechanical equivalent of heat. The more precise the measurements are made, and the better it is ensured that the entire movement is converted into measurable heat, the more precisely the ratios obtained in different tests agree with each other. That is the actual result of the experience. Close quote, Steiner again. Here we have a whole theory of physics before us in a single sentence. What leads to this theory can already be shown by the very simple fact that when we run a finger over a surface, it becomes warm. You can check that for yourself. This energy, this muscle energy of your own that you are expending, is not heat at first. But heat occurs, and energy is lost. What happened here? Your energy has been transformed into heat. If you press here, for example, a certain amount of heat is generated. If you apply a different energy, heat is also produced. Now, you might think that it arises erratically, but that is not the case. The question as to what the relationship is between the expenditure of energy and the heat that is generated from it has been the subject of important research. In 1842, Julius Robert Meyer, who was treated rather badly by his peers at the time, although today he is considered a scientific authority of the first order, first drew attention to the fact that the relationship between energy and the resulting heat is something constant, and he also tried to give the ratio. In his treatise written in 1842, it is still stated imprecisely. Subsequent scholars then established and stated the exact number through their research. Helmholtz, who disputed the priority of the discovery, set out to prove that there was such a ratio, a constant ratio, between the energy expended and the resulting heat. Equal amounts of energy give equal amounts of heat, and the ratio that exists between heat and expended energy is as constant as the ratio to the constants is constant. This is called the mechanical equivalent of heat. That's how you get a law of physics. Quote, "The physicist goes beyond experience when they replace the observational results, which always differ from each other, with a simple common formula. They are entitled to do so as long as they are aware of the conditions under which the formula is valid." Close quote, Steiner again. A formula is already created by the fact that I say when energy is transformed into heat, there is a certain relationship between energy and heat. But even though there are many cases that have been investigated, the cases that will be investigated the day after tomorrow have not yet been investigated today. So when the physicist states a formula in such a context, they must be aware of the scope within which such a formula can be valid. Quote, "Similarly, all laws of nature can be shown to transcend experience in their simplification." Close quote, Steiner again. So that basically you are already going beyond experience if you do not stop at the description of the individual case. Let us now consider the next chapter in relation to the whole of its thrust. It is called, quote, "Cognition progresses from the simple to the complex. The phenomena of the sensory world, as they confront us, are so complex that in order to fathom their connection, the human being is compelled first to limit their attention to the simplest, and only then, step by step, to expand the field of what has been comprehended. The apparent, uniform, circular motion of the heavenly bodies offered in its simplicity the possibility of applying the absolute truths of mathematics to empirical facts of observation, and thereby predicting future events by calculation." Close quote, Steiner again. For future lunar or solar eclipses, as I mentioned last time, this is based on observing the stars, putting their movements into formulas, and then inserting certain variables into these formulas. This makes it possible to indicate the day when, say in 1950, there will be a solar eclipse. Quote, "This successful activity developed the capability of presenting large groups of phenomena in a clear, generally valid mathematical form. In the geocentric world system, the concept of natural events governed by laws was expressed in a sublime way. Around the earth resting in the center of the world, the crystal brightness of the celestial sphere, with the countless stars attached to it, rotated with unchanging uniformity. Only 7 celestial bodies, the sun, the moon, and the 5 planets visible to the naked eye, have their own movement, for the illustration of which various combinations of circular movements were used. Finally, the meaningful but complicated so-called Ptolemaic system with its cycles and epicycles arose." Close quote, Steiner again. The earlier world system was geocentric, which assumed that the Earth was at the center of the world and that the other stars somehow revolved around it. And this was how the world mechanism was observed. The movements could also be calculated mathematically. It is not relevant that people held a view of the world that is no longer valid among astronomers today. Quote, "With the increasing accuracy of the observations and the expansion of knowledge, the difficulties grew in representing the observed facts in this way with mathematical accuracy, until finally the boldest and most momentous of all scientific hypotheses, the Copernican hypothesis, solved the difficulties." Close quote, Steiner again. It happened like this. Today, the situation is considerably different. It was assumed that the Earth was at the center, that the starry sky moved around, and that the planets had their own motion. It was assumed that such a planet moved in a circle, which itself moved in a circle. It had to be imagined in epicycles. It was necessary to have a very complicated understanding of space, which complicated the whole worldview. Now, a principle came into human thinking that contributed significantly to to the Copernican worldview gaining a foothold. This was the principle that has never been invoked more often than then. Nature does everything in the simplest way. But that, it was said, she had not done in the simplest way. And here it was Copernicus who simply turned things around. He said, let's try to put the sun in the center and let the other celestial bodies move around it. And so another astronomical picture of the world emerged, the Copernican one. I've already mentioned to you that it was not until 1822 that the Church allowed a Catholic to believe in this system. Quote, the Earth diminished from its position of rest at the center of the world to a satellite of the sun, revolving around it like the other planets at breakneck speed, turning like a spindle on its axis. This is a conception so contrary to appearances and the teaching of the Church that its endeavor to nip the heretical doctrine in the bud is understandable. The reasons which urged the acceptance of this hypothesis could at first be fully appreciated only by those who were aware of how much more simply the results of the observations were explained by this hypothesis than if the Earth were assumed to be at rest. Admittedly, the distances separating us from the fixed stars had to be imagined to be unfathomably large. Close quote. Steiner again. Now comes an argument which is important, but which we must make the subject of special consideration at this point. Quote, incidentally, full proof of the correctness of the Copernican hypothesis was only provided 2.5 centuries later by the discovery of the so-called aberration of light, and even later by the measurement of some stellar parallaxes. Close quote, Steiner again. From what stellar parallaxes and aberration of light are, you will see that the Copernican worldview was indeed subject to some uncertainty until these discoveries. Quote, the mathematical method, which had been strengthened by the study of the movements of the stars, was gradually applied also to the phenomena of earthly lifeless nature, which were closer to us and therefore presented themselves in a more complex way. Statics, the theory of the equilibrium of forces, was already developed by the ancients. Then, not until the revival of the exact sciences, dynamics, the mathematical theory of movement. Galileo investigated the laws of falling bodies. He recognizes them intuitively, expresses them in formulas, tests and proves them through meaningful experiments that enable more precise measurement. Close quote. Steiner again. There it is pointed out how it is basically a penetration of external phenomena with mathematical ideas that science aims for. The Ptolemaic worldview also aimed to extend the mathematical part like a net. When you see a star, you must already have grasped the mathematical concept of the circle, if you are to say the star moves in a circle. So you connect the mathematical with what you see empirically. This is also done in a large part of mechanical science, for example in statics, which is concerned with investigating the conditions under which the equilibrium of forces is brought about, whereby dynamics investigates the conditions under which movements can be controlled, and so on. So we see how sciences are formed by infusing what is externally, empirically perceived with mathematics. Quote, Newton eventually applies the earthly laws of falling bodies to celestial phenomena. He proves mathematically that the same force that propels the apple to the earth, the mutual attraction of two masses of matter, forces the moon to revolve around the earth, and the planets, together with the earth, to describe their orbits around the sun, whose elliptical shape, discovered by Kepler, corresponds to the requirements of mechanics. Close quote, Steiner again. Newton's famous apple anecdote is considered here. Who once sat under an apple tree and saw an apple fall down? Now you may ask, why does the apple fall down? For the naive person, this is not really a scientific question. This is where the scientific person reveals themselves, in that something that is not a question for the naive person becomes a question for them. The naive person finds it quite natural that the apple falls down, but it could also remain hanging, and it would do so if a force were not exerted by the earth. The earth attracts it to itself. If you now imagine the earth and the moon going around the earth, you will realize that the moon would have to fly away if another force did not act against it. Just remember what boys do. Maybe girls too, but I don't know. Suppose you have an object. Tie it to a thread, hold the thread at one end, and move it around in a circle. Try to cut the thread and the object will fly away. The moon also goes around like that, but why does it not fly away? At every point it aspires to do so. If we suppose that the earth were not there, it would certainly fly away. But because the earth is there, it attracts the moon, and it attracts the moon in such a way that the moon does not go to A, but goes to B after a certain time. The earth must always attract it in order to hold it in a circle. This is the same force, Newton said to himself, as that which acts on the apple that the earth pulls down toward itself. It also uses it to keep the moon in its orbit. This is the same force with which celestial bodies attract each other in general and keep themselves in their orbits. We see the force in the falling apple, the same force, the general force of attraction, gravity, is in the celestial bodies. The rest about the calculation, how such gravity works, how it decreases with distance, and so on, these are details. It was precisely with this Newtonian theory of gravitation that a very important chapter of the scientific worldview was initiated, a chapter that was basically established right up to our own time. It is only in our time that this is being challenged to some extent. I have, after all, drawn your attention to how a so-called theory of relativity is challenging this, but we will talk about that another time. Quote, "It was not until the discovery of the laws of gravity that the worldview became a unified one, encompassing the entire cosmos. The sublime idea of a cause, force, working everywhere and with necessity, measurable in its effects, therefore suitable for objective examination, accustoms the human mind to look everywhere for such examination, and always to strive to trace phenomena back to as few basic assumptions as possible. The progress of European science depends substantially on the application of this principle." Close quote, Steiner again. Indeed, much revolves around the application of this principle. I have already drawn your attention several times to how, as a 12-year-old boy, I was surprised by a treatise in the school program, in which an attempt was made to explain phenomena in a way other than by gravitation. That caused me a lot of headache at the time, because I was not yet very familiar with the formulas, with the integral and differential formulas, with which the treatise was interspersed. But I can, nevertheless, tell you what it was all about, if I leave all that out. Think of the earth here, the moon there. He draws, and there's a diagram. That is, the earth acts on the moon through empty space, so it has an effect over distance. Now, there was a lot of thinking about whether such an effect could really take place over distance. Many were of the opinion that a body cannot act where it is not, and others said that a body is where it acts. Schramm, the author of the treatise mentioned, says, "The whole theory of gravitation is mysticism, for it assumes that one cosmic body extends into the invisible in order to attract another. Whether it is a cosmic body or a molecule, it makes no difference. So they were there at a certain distance." Now he claims the following. "The cosmic bodies are not there alone. Space is filled with bodies. There are many more bodies. But they are not at rest either. They are in constant motion. If we now imagine that these bodies are all in motion, then they are continually bumping into this body that we are imagining here. Bodies bump into each other here as well. But there are also bodies bumping from the inside, so that the body is bumped from all sides." And now he calculates the number and effect of these impacts. You can see very easily that here are smaller areas to be knocked, and here larger areas. But because there is less impact here than out there, the bodies are forced together. You have here the result of the force of attraction, composed of different impacts by the fact that they take place in different numbers. So there is drumming there. There is drumming there. So there must be fewer impacts from the inside to the outside than from the outside to the inside. The bodies, therefore, have a tendency to come together. They are driven together by the individual impacts. This man, Schramm, tried to replace gravitational force with another way of drawing together. He tried to eliminate the mysticism in the theory of gravitation. A treatise was written by Paul Dubois-Raymond, in which it was mathematically proved that such collisions are never possible, which are equal to the phenomenon of gravitation. This is how science goes about its work. It tries to arrive at principles from uncertain premises, then to overturn them again in order to return to the old principles. If Paul Dubois-Raymond's arguments are correct, we must return to what is older. So we come back to what was to be rejected. This is an interesting case that can show you how science works. Quote, "The progress of European science depends substantially on the application of this principle. In this way, it was gradually possible to unify, within inanimate nature, ever more and larger areas of manifestation, to trace the phenomena of mechanics, heat, light, sound, electricity, magnetism, and chemical affinity back to transformations of a quantitatively indestructible something which we call energy, and whose measurable magnitude is expressed by the product of the moving mass with the square of the velocity." Close quote, Steiner again. That is to say, attention is drawn here to the fact that if we form a worldview in this way, we arrive at the assumption of an energy that is in space. I have already pointed out what the naturalist Ostwald said, that it is not the slap that matters, but the energy that is applied. And so, hypothetically speaking, you can have a material body here, brackets, it was evidently drawn. How do you perceive it? Only by the fact that a different spatial expansion can be noted here than in the surrounding area. But that is also only a pushback, just as you, when you see a body, cannot perceive anything other than what acts with a certain force on the eyes. So matter can be replaced by energy. What we call matter can only be energy everywhere. And so observation and the mathematical law according to which movements proceed provides the basis that the law of energy can be expressed by the product of the moving mass and the square of the velocity. But to discuss this would take us too far. It can be done at some later time. Quote, "Up to now, no authenticated fact is known which contradicts the basic assumption of the mechanical view within inanimate nature. On the other hand, innumerable conclusions logically or mathematically derived from it have been confirmed by empirical examination, and indeed the lawful linkage of events and the indestructibility of mass and energy is confirmed all the more surely the more exactly the examination is undertaken, the smaller the possible errors in the measurements are." Close quote, Steiner again. It is pointed out here that a certain comprehensive physical law can be inferred from observation. The easiest way to come to this law is to say, we have a certain energy. We transform it into heat. Heat, in turn, we see this in steam engines and so on, can undergo another transformation. It can be converted into another energy. This transformation takes place in corresponding ratios. That is to say, we are led to the so-called law of the conservation of energy, that is, to the law which is expressed thus. In the universe there is a certain sum of energy. It transforms itself. When a certain amount of energy, let's say heat, is transformed, energy disappears on one side, but on the other side there is a different energy. So there is a transformation of energy. This is a law that plays an important role, and for which in recent times the attempt has been made to extend it to the entire worldview. And that brings us to the next chapter. Quote, "Extension of the mechanical conception to the organic." However, this has only been proven numerically within the inorganic world, in so far as we receive impressions of it through our five senses. It is understandable that this conception of the application of laws should also be applied to organic, animate nature. But the question is, to what extent are we entitled to do so? Close quote, Steiner again. So that means, if we compare these energies, apply the law of energy, that you can apply to everything that is inanimate, inorganic nature, and now try to encompass organic nature with the same law. That is why the next chapter is called, quote, "Difference between inanimate and animate bodies." What is the difference between an animate and inanimate body? We call a body animate when material changes take place in it, not only according to physical and chemical laws, but when, in addition to these forces, which alone act in inanimate nature, other forces also act, which are peculiar to every species and every individual, and which condition the growth, reproduction, and death of every living individual being. Close quote. Steiner again. It is the characteristic of living beings that they grow, reproduce, and die. We do not find this with the inorganic. But now there is a tendency in the mechanical materialistic worldview to apply the same principles that are applied to the inorganic world, to the animate beings, to the organic. Quote, "Whether we ascribe these laws to a life force or to some other hypothetical cause, the fact is that the gap between the organic and the inorganic has not yet been bridged, and that the more precise the observations are made, the more certain it becomes that living things only arise from living things." Close quote, Steiner again. Now a sentence follows that can be found quoted numerous times. Here it is put as, quote, "The opposite assumption, that the animate is only another arrangement of the inanimate, is for the time being a hypothesis not confirmed by any fact." Close quote. Steiner again. But I have also mentioned something else, and it is important to consider the latter with reference to this point of view. For it might be thought that the validity of a spiritual worldview depends on it not being possible to prove how a living thing comes into being from inorganic substances. Yet there was a long period that was grounded in the spiritual worldview and yet believed that a homunculus could be produced in a laboratory. So the spiritual worldview has not always been made dependent on it not being possible to make living things arise from lifeless things. It is part of our time to emphasize that living things only arise from living things, and that the spiritual worldview attaches to this. I have often said how Francesco Redi, as late as about 200 years ago, stated the proposition, quote, "Living things can only come from living things," close quote, and proved it incorrect that the animate can arise from the inanimate. It is also important that science points out that there is a gulf between the organic and the inorganic. Ferdinand Cohn emphasized at the Natural Scientists meeting in Berlin that the laws used to prove the inorganic are not sufficient to prove the organic. We might cite Bunge from Basel, and Julius Wiesner, the botanist, says, "The further botany progresses, the more it becomes apparent how a gulf exists between the inorganic and the organic." Rangel therefore says, quote, "So if we want to remain within what is scientifically established at present, we must distinguish between two essentially different groups of phenomena, the animate and the inanimate." Close quote. Steiner again. The next chapter is called, quote, "Consciousness." We humans encounter another phenomenon through inner experience, consciousness with its expressions, which are feeling, thinking, volition. We have no compelling reason to suppose that the plant also thinks and wills, and without leaving the ground of experience, are justified in still making the distinction within the organic kingdom between the unconscious vegetable and the conscious animal. Close quote, Steiner again. We have often talked about how there are people who want to blur the distinction between the vegetable and the animal, who claim that plants attract and devour living beings. You also know a creature like this that attracts creatures that come near and then devours them. That is a mouse trap, and yet we need not assume that a mouse trap has an animal soul in it. Quote, "All phenomena that are connected with consciousness we call spiritual phenomena." Close quote. Steiner again. We would have to say more precisely, all phenomena which we bring to consciousness, for in spiritual science, we must also call spiritual that which is not astral body and I, capital. When you are only in the physical body and etheric body, we are not dealing with consciousness, but with spiritual activity. Quote, Thus the world, as far as we become aware of it, by means of our five senses and our faculty of thought, appears to contain three essentially different principles: matter, which is immutable in its mass and in its properties, life, which obeys its own laws, and the spiritual. Close quote, Steiner again. I would also like to point out that even philosophers outside of spiritual science, such as Edward von Hartmann and others, have spoken of an unconscious spiritual part, so that we, in brackets, there is a gap in the transcript. Then, quote, in science, which has the inorganic as its object, the assumption proves itself, as we have already said, that cause and effect stand in a numerically fixed relation to each other, that all that happens within this world of the inanimate follows the strict law of necessity. Biological science, which sets itself the task of investigating the phenomena of life, proceeds in accordance with the nature of every science from the same assumption. Since, however, in the case of many phenomena of life, measurement, hence numerical testing of the lawful course of changes, that is, of events, is not applicable, the rule of the necessary unalterable linkage of cause and effect cannot be perfectly proven in the field of biology. But there is nothing to be said against it, and the intrinsic probability, as well as the analogy with what we know for sure, speaks in favor of it. In any case, this assumption must be the basis of all scientific research, because its task is to discover these laws. Close quote, Steiner again. Now, I have pointed out in various lectures how in more recent times efforts are being made to trace numerical constancy right up to animal and human phenomena. Rubner, for example, tried to prove how much heat energy is contained in the food that a certain animal receives, and then he tried to prove how much heat the animal develops in the occurrences of its life. From the resulting constant number, it follows that the heat absorbed with the food reappears in the activity. The activity was transformed food. Another researcher extended this to the psychological sphere by testing a number of students. The principle of applying numerical ratios is quite good. This can be applied to all these phenomena. We will talk tomorrow about how this is quite correct, but logically the matter is usually kept very short-sighted, for someone could, after all, according to the same logical laws by which Rubner proceeds, examine how the monetary values, or the equivalents for them, which are carried into the bank, and likewise, all those which are carried out, correspond. They have to correspond to each other, after all. If we were to conclude from this that there are no people in the bank who do this, that would certainly be wrong. If we examine the food that is introduced into the organism and the energy that comes out again and find a correspondence between them, we should not suppose that the soul is not involved. Then comes another chapter. Quote, the spiritual phenomena. If we look at spiritual phenomena, they are, for ordinary sensory observation, linked to certain material conditions, and this could give rise to the materialistic view according to which spiritual phenomena would not exist at all without the material basis of a living being with its brain, nerves, etc. Close quote. Steiner again. This assumption arose to such an extent that Dubois Raymond said in one of his speeches that if you wanted to speak of a world soul, you had to show where the world brain was. He said, if you want to speak of a world of the soul, you must show where there is a brain of the world. That is how much it has been reinterpreted in terms of materialism. Because when you observe the human being in the physical world, you see that everything psychological is bound to the brain. Quote, most people have always had an inner aversion to this view, and the belief in the independent existence of spiritual entities and their interaction with the world of the senses, with which we are familiar, has been expressed in the most diverse forms of religious and spiritualist ideas. Very many facts which are supposed to be direct confirmations of such a view are certainly based on deception and delusion. Close quote, Steiner again. We have also been through some of these deceptions and delusions in recent times here. It is of great importance that anyone who stands on the ground of the spiritual, scientific worldview is free from deception and delusion. Quote, In recent times, however, well-authenticated factual material has been brought together, which makes the assumption of a spiritual world appear to be the most probable hypothesis for its explanation, so that it would now be unscientific to simply reject the latter out of hand, as it was done only a few decades ago. Steiner again. And now this is discussed further in the following chapter. Quote, the occult capabilities of the human being. If numerous facts that can be perceived with the ordinary senses already suggest, if not demand, a spiritualistic interpretation, then it must be added that many credible people claim to possess, in addition to the five senses, other organs of perception not developed in most people, which allow them to enter into direct contact with the spiritual world. That the five senses of the human being do not exhaust all the possibilities of perceptive abilities must be assumed a priori, and is confirmed by some phenomena in the animal world. There is therefore no justification for denying it. But it is a scientific duty to examine the facts in question carefully, without prejudice, which is also now being done by many outstanding representatives of the exact sciences. For very many people who have occult experiences themselves or hear of them from credible persons, the existence of spiritual worlds is a proven fact, and the possibility of gaining insight into the riddles of the world by penetrating them is not subject to doubt. Since time immemorial, doctrines have developed from such supposed or real insights, sometimes spreading as secret teachings among a select few, sometimes appearing as openly taught religious systems. Of the great world religions, the European cultural world is most closely interwoven with Christian teachings. Close quote. Steiner again. Now, it is important that we use such a debate to build on it how spiritual science positions itself in this regard. Spiritual science today, when it takes into account all that human development has gone through up to the present day, takes the standpoint not so much to emphasize that there are already other organs of perception apart from the human being's five senses. You know, if you look back on much of what we have discussed, that there are other organs. But to emphasize that other organs of perception can be formed. Title, Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved?, describes what we have to do so that such organs can be formed. It is important that the spiritual science of today claims the same general applicability as other science, maybe in a different sense, but still in a certain sense. The other science tries to obtain knowledge that applies to all people. Spiritual science seeks to train such organs of perception that can be developed by all human beings. If the scientist can examine what is asserted, the person who trains the spiritual organs can examine what spiritual science asserts. Ordinary science reckons with those capabilities that are already there, spiritual science with those that can be developed. Now, let us look at the principle according to which these capabilities are developed. How these capabilities are developed is described in detail in Title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved? Now I just want to briefly state how such capabilities are to be understood. When a symphony is played, there is actually nothing more than oscillations of the air in the room. These oscillations of the air can also be calculated mathematically. And if we made enough calculations, we could express all the movement that takes place in the instrument and in the air mathematically as the sum of the facts comprising the movement. We could abstract completely from the symphony we are listening to and say to ourselves, I don't care about Beethoven's symphony. I want to be a mathematician and investigate what states of motion apply. If we proceeded like this, we would cut out the symphony and have only the states of motion. But you will have to admit that the symphony is also still there. It cannot be denied, and is something other than the mere image of the states of motion. What happened there? After all, Beethoven, in a certain way, only caused such states of motion to arise. But that does not yet give a real symphony. If you now imagine that a human being applies all those capabilities which are otherwise applied to comprehend the outer physical world, in order to obtain such laws as the intuitive laws of mathematics and logic are, that is, the laws which the human being develops by being a thinking human being. And if they treated themselves in this way by means of these laws, as the composer does with the states of motion of the air, if they do not accept the capabilities of mathematics and logic and other capabilities as they are, but work on them inwardly, then something arises in them that is something different from the empirical capabilities of logic, mathematics, and empirical research. Compare this and the treatment that the composer gives to the air with what we do inwardly, and look at what emerges. Then you have the possibility of saying, here we have a human being who has the capability of empirical research, the capability of forming mathematical and logical judgments. That is just like a sum of the states of movement that are in the instruments and in the air. But if you treat them again in a certain way, the result is a symphony, a musical work of art. The laws by which we treat ourselves are just such as are given in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved? Then something arises that is still in development, that is a consequence of human activity. And just as the person who has a musical ear not only perceives the oscillations from the instruments and the air, so the person who has developed the inner senses not only perceives the sensory, the mathematical, not only the logical world, but they also perceive the spiritual world. Such nurturing of something new on the basis of what is already there leads us to work our way into a spiritual world. Thus, for spiritual science, it is a matter of recognizing that the capabilities that the human being already has can be developed, just as the movements of the instruments in the air can be developed. It is on the basis of this capacity for further development that the human being can develop toward a conception of the world that gives them something that they do not perceive without this further development. The essential thing about spiritual science is that it points to the possibility of the further development of certain capabilities, not to the existence of those that are already present, but to their further development. And then it is correct when Rangel says that in the various systems of religion, the same thing is referred to as in the secret teachings. The next chapter is called, quote, Essence of the Teachings of Jesus. If we regard what is common to all the countless interpretations of Jesus' teachings as the essence of Christianity, it consists in the good news that the Creator and Controller of the universe is a loving Father to the human being whom He created in His image, that love for God and our fellow human beings is the highest moral commandment, that the soul of the human being is eternal, and that after death a lot will be prepared for it which corresponds to the moral conduct of the human being during their life. Close quote, Steiner again. In the way that we have worked on the essence of Christianity with the instrument of spiritual science, it must be said that what is pronounced here is the content of Jesus' teachings, but not the essence of Christianity. The essence of Christianity consists of a development that has taken place in time. In that, the human being, Jesus, was implanted with the Godhead. That is, that a being which until then had not been connected with the earth, connected itself with it through the familiar process, whereby time is thus divided into a pre-Christian and a post-Christian era. Such an understanding of the appearance of the Christ being on earth is part of the essence of Christianity. Quote, the conspicuous aberrations into which the organized Christian communities, the historical churches, have fallen, have brought their dogmas into opposition with some firmly established scientific achievements, and have thus brought about the conflict between faith and knowledge, religion and science, which is corroding the spiritual life of the European cultural world. This situation explains the interest that has turned to other religious systems that claim not only to be in harmony with science, but also to extend it. Among these teachings, theosophy deserves special attention. Since the European cultural world was made aware by H.P. Blavatsky of this teaching, which originated in India, it has found various representations. Close quote, Steiner again. Whenever the word theosophy is uttered, it is important to draw attention to what spiritual science is and what the theosophical worldview is. Tomorrow, I think I will be able to finish. But I still have to discuss in what way Blavatsky's teaching originated in India, and in what way it did not originate in India. And I have to go into some things that separate spiritual science from much of what is called theosophy. Of that, then, tomorrow. The end of Lecture 7.